This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. More people are living with HIV than have died since the epidemic began, according to the United Nations. Medical and social advances mean that those with the disease today do live longer and fuller lives, but there's still a lot we can learn from the early days of the epidemic. Wendy Wexberg collected and edited firsthand accounts from the researchers, advocates, and survivors who were there at the beginning. Those stories are compiled in her latest book, HIV Pioneers: Lives Lost, Careers Changed, and Survival. Wendy Wexberg is the director and principal researcher of the Substance Use, Gender, and Applied Research Program at RTI International. She's also the founding director of the Global Gender Center there. Wendy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell me about why you chose to write this book now. It's been almost four decades since the epidemic began. What was it that inspired you to put this collection together?
Well, those of us who've been around that long, very important people were dying. As I wrote in the beginning, it was actually 4 years ago, somebody really important in India had died when I heard that Suniti Solomon had died, and she was the first one to diagnose AIDS in India. And I had visited her when I was on sabbatical and saw what she was doing for the wives of people who had died and had this huge care center. And she was so gracious when I was there and was real in the country, but just gracious and was known globally. And just I thought her story needed to be told, and her son was unable to do it at the time. I mean, there were several people I've contacted that were unable to do it still, so you never know if I'll continue these stories. And another very, very dear friend who I traveled with and worked with, Jim Inciardi, who wrote many books about women and crack and sex workers and so on, he had died a few years earlier. And I thought, these were really important pioneers, and we're losing those stories. And there are people that I still see, and we need to talk about what it was like in the early days, because we knew so little, and we've learned so much, but we're still on that journey.
There was an urgency to this need to sort of document what we knew at the beginning. Can you jump forward a little bit now just to give us context? When we said at the beginning of the show, there are more people living with HIV now than have died since the beginning of the epidemic. Where are we now?
Well, we have quite a more comprehensive toolkit. We didn't know what to do in the early days. We thought people were going to die we didn't know what was. Then we thought people would die within a few years, and we were figuring out the right kind of medications. But now we have medications that prolong people's lives if we can make sure that they stay on their medications. And we also have medications to keep people from getting HIV as long as we can reach them and they can access health care. So our toolkit has expanded, and now we just need to make sure it's accessible.
One of the things this book does well is look at it through a global lens. Can you paint a picture of how HIV/AIDS has sort of evolved globally as an epidemic?
The problem globally, I mean, I can speak for now, are the areas where, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, where we're dealing with great poverty. So if you're looking where the epidemic is, I'm more concerned about where women are, poor women. I've also worked in Eastern Europe where the injecting drug use problem is. Did a project in Russia, did a problem in with colleagues in the Republic of Georgia with women. And if we look globally, you know, we're looking more in Africa, where sub-Saharan Africa, where there's a problem. But there are parts all around the world. Some countries and some continents have done better with their response than others. And a lot of it also had to do with PEPFAR. PEPFAR did an incredible job of a response with getting technical assistance in the ground and getting help with NGOs. It was the President's Emergency Response.
Okay.
And that was actually started by Bush.
Well, I want to obviously continue to talk more about the evolution, but to learn what we can from the past, I'd like to bring in another guest. He's a pioneer from the early days of HIV and AIDS. Dr. Charles Vanderhorst is an emeritus professor in medicine and infectious diseases at the UNC School of Medicine. Charlie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
So I know that as a medical intern, you encountered one of the first patients who would be diagnosed with what we then learned was AIDS. Can you tell me a bit about that patient who showed up in the emergency room and briefly what happened?
So I was an intern and resident in the Bronx, and in the spring of 1980, which was towards the end of my internship, I went down to the emergency room to admit a patient who was on a ventilator already and to escort him to the ICU. And he looked like he'd been out of a concentration camp. He had a terrible pneumonia, weird skin lesions, and it was sort of a baffling complex of syndromes.
And what you write in the narrative, to me, you describe this sense of utter disorientation as a medical provider, not having any sense of how these various symptoms came together to make this man experience what he was experiencing. Can you describe what that felt like and how the medical community was responding to that disorientation at the time?
Well, it was an enormous challenge for, you know, the epidemic wasn't, we didn't realize there was any problem until the U.S. Centers for Disease Control published two reports in June of 1981, the following year. But with this, we just had this patient having various diagnoses. So we diagnosed the pneumonia, we diagnosed the skin lesions as a rare form of cancer, and he had this bizarre herpes lesions as well. And we were able to diagnose each of those individually. The problem is we'd not seen them all together in a single constellation like that. So, you know, as a healthcare worker, you methodically go through problems and symptoms that patients have, and you try to diagnose them, but then you want to treat them and you want to figure out why they have them. You don't want to just diagnose them on, you want to figure out why they developed pneumonia at that particular point, and that we came up against a brick wall, which continued for the next several years until the virus was discovered in 1983.
Can you talk a bit about the social stigma surrounding those with HIV and how that transferred into what was seen in the medical world?
So when people quickly realized it was a contagious disease, so these patients were shunned by doctors and nurses and family members, and it was a very, very difficult time for my patients. So I had a patient, a young mother in North Carolina, who was transported to a local emergency room in rural North Carolina, and she died in that emergency room as they declined to start treating her easy-to-treat pneumonia. So things like that were happening. We had a Lieutenant Governor James Gardner, who was a very conservative Lieutenant Governor in North Carolina from 89 to 93. He did his best to stigmatize patients and healthcare workers who took care of them, and we were fighting against him constantly at the time.
Wendy, I know one of the things that it seems like you try to do in the book is look at the stories of people who have HIV who are maybe not, who don't fit into the stereotype of what we think a young, gay, white man. Can you tell me a bit about your choice to look through all of these lenses and maybe what we can learn about how stigma was felt by a variety of groups in these early days?
Well, I mean, there are a variety of stories, particularly the one about the Black church, and as far as how a Black man, particularly in the Army, how the Army treated him, how the Black church reacted, because the Black church actually was very important here in North Carolina in how we got them involved in dealing with HIV, because there was tremendous denial for a while. And so people's stereotype about how somebody should be or how they should be fixed if they choose to be gay has changed in these 30 years with acceptability, because, you know, gender is... When we think of one gender, it's a spectrum of understanding people's sexuality and traditional expectations and values about sexuality. And so some of the stories actually talk about that. And in the end, there's some beautiful families that come to understanding with love with people who are actually living with HIV. And also about partners and understanding what that's like to have love relationships and also loss.
There's also a fascinating story in the book told from the perspective of a nurse who contracted HIV on the job. Can you tell me a bit about her story and what you think it illuminates about what we can learn from the early days of the epidemic?
Actually, that story is one of the most important stories because it changed the healthcare laws with the first needle stick. And that story was most important because that could have been avoided as far as the needle with the retractable needles and so on. So knowing what happened with her story and how it was taken, how hospitals respond now and protection, and we have now prophylactic. We can take care of people when they get a needle stick. But that whole scenario of what occurred to this, she just got her nursing license. She just got out of school. She was so excited about working in an emergency room, but has lived her whole life with a series of one thing after another, and yet has had a family. And I had to cut all that out because there was so much more to her story. But she has carried on as much as she's been, had incredible courage, but definitely changed the laws with how we deal with healthcare workers and needle sticks. So that story was very, very important to have in the book.
Charlie, one of the things that stood out to me from reading your piece and reading other narratives from healthcare providers was how HIV illuminated our need for a psychosocial approach to not just focus on the doctor-patient relationship, but to bring in a social worker, to bring in a psychologist. Can you talk a bit about how you saw this evolve over the course of the epidemic?
So it quickly became clear that, particularly when you have inadequate treatment, but even when you have good treatment, which we developed the triple drug therapy in the mid-90s, you need a team approach. You need social workers and nurses and physical therapists and occupational therapists and public health people and community workers, et cetera, and community groups. To help the families, to help the patients, you need to get housing for them, you need to get food to them, you need to make sure they get to clinic. And so I quickly learned to get off my high horse as the physician in the White Coast and listen to other experts, people like Wendy, for instance, who I've learned an enormous amount on how to get the patients, get them on treatment and keep them on treatment.
When did you start to see the biggest transition in how HIV/AIDS patients were perceived?
So I think one of the key things was actually November 7th, 1991. And I have a specific date then because that's when Magic Johnson announced that he was infected. And he looked great. He was a star. And it was a courageous thing that he did. And it sort of said, oh, wait, you know, we love this guy, you know, all of America loved him, and he has HIV, and he's a nice guy, and we like him, and so we're going to treat him well. And even though he did get some pushback initially, that went away. In 1993, Tom Hanks was in a movie called Philadelphia about a HIV-infected man, and I think that also humanized patients with HIV. But of course, you know, we still are fighting for rights here in the United States. It wasn't until 2017 that the Supreme Court upheld the right of gay people to marry.
2015, I think. But yeah, obviously still a lot of efforts to fight for equal rights. I wonder, Wendy, you know, we mentioned these moments in the 80s and 90s, and today maybe people think HIV is a thing of the past or a thing that doesn't impact people in the United States as much. But there still are new cases and populations, even of our state, where there are high incidences of HIV. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of this idea that HIV is over and how you'd like to reframe that?
HIV is not over. With a study we have in three health departments in North Carolina, we are worried about women who are still getting STIs, which means they're having unprotected sex. And among, you know, Hispanics, we're worried about new incident cases of HIV. So even though we've done a good job of trying to control HIV, we still are worried about women, particularly in the South, women that are African-American particularly, and that's been the same problem over all these years of the cases of women of color getting HIV. And it's not just looking and saying, oh, it's women and women of color, but we also have to look contextually at other social determinants of reasons why women, just like we do in sub-Saharan Africa, why is HIV have a woman's face. We've said that for a long time. It's not anything new. There are a lot of other social determinants of why women have HIV. And these are childbearing women. That's why reaching them, getting them on treatment, or reaching them and getting them tested. If they're HIV, we want them on medication, we want them on ARVs, and we want them to adhere. If they're not, we'd love to get them on PrEP, and that's what we're really trying to do in countries where we have a lot of prevalence.
And what are those social determinants?
Well, the biggest social determinant is poverty. And, you know, when women say to me, I'm not going to take my drugs because I'm hungry, getting food is more important. Feeding my children is more important. So adherence is a major problem. And so taking your medication or wanting to share your medication with somebody else. So we deal with people who are very, very poor. And yet those are the people that don't have a voice. So it's the voiceless, the people that have less power, that may not have access to health departments. They may have run out of their medication. So is this over? No, it's not over. Do people have a big voice? No. And I think people are working really hard in clinics, but there's big vacancies in some clinics that can't fulfill the jobs where I'm working, for example, in South Africa. They don't have money. Governments are pretty stretched. Government clinics are very stretched. They can't fill the jobs. That means there's long lines. That means there's gaps in treatment.
So, Charlie, I know that you have some thoughts about lessons learned from HIV/AIDS that can maybe be applied to other epidemics. Can you tell me a little bit about that and maybe what you feel like we've learned from Ebola, for example? How did our response compare to our response to HIV/AIDS and what lessons should we take from both of those moving forward?
So it's interesting. So there were some huge missteps with Ebola. We were slow in getting emergency funds. They were held up by the lack of a budget resolution by the Republican Congress, and so it delayed funding, and then now they've created a response team, funding for a response team that would be ready for the next epidemic, but that's proposed cut by President Trump. There was panic with Ebola about healthcare workers by the medical centers, hospitals, and universities. There was no provision of evacuation insurance, life insurance for these people, and Governor Christie in New Jersey, put some of these heroes in jail. There was a double standard of treatment for European and U.S. Healthcare workers compared to the African healthcare workers, and we had the extreme example of a Texas hospital who totally screwed up with a patient with Ebola who had delayed diagnosis and inadequate protection of the healthcare workers. All those things were quite similar to what happened with the AIDS epidemic. So, lots of similarities in that. Their policies were based on fear and stigma about the patients and those who treated them. The good thing that we saw both with Ebola and AIDS is that people ran toward the fire, as my colleague David Wall said. People volunteered to be in clinical trials, to conduct clinical trials, to get the treatments we have. The clinicians provided patient care. People shared their stories, and that was really a wonderful thing. And we made, great strides with AIDS, but there are other epidemics are going to come along. We saw that with Ebola and before that with SARS and, avian influenza is lingering there. So you can never rest your guard with epidemics.
And Wendy, I only have about 30 seconds left, but if there's one lesson that we can take away from all of these HIV pioneers as we move forward through Ebola to now the opioid epidemic, what lesson would that be?
Well, I have a lot of gratitude and compassion, and I've learned a great deal, and there's a network of people who are working at this still so hard. The lesson is that we've learned a lot. We still haven't learned everything, and I'm just grateful that what science does is that we ask the next question and we're going to get better. And as we get better, we're all going to keep healing. But we just need to not quit.
Thank you so much. Dr. Charles Vanderhorst is an emeritus professor in medicine and infectious diseases at the UNC School of Medicine. And Wendy Wexberg is the editor of HIV Pioneers, Lives Lost, Careers Changed, and Survival. She's also the director and principal researcher of the Substance Use, Gender, and Applied Research Program at RTI International and the founding director of the Global Gender Center there. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Just ahead, our movie expert Laura Boyes launches a new series that skips over the damsels in distress. Stay with us.